argument today is Avila against Pappas. Mr. Jakowiak.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Lawrence Jakowiak on behalf of the plaintiff Maria Avila. Certain facts we don't dispute in this case, including a not very pretty fact that the plaintiff was having a phone conversation with a coworker after work in the evening. And
before we get very far into the merits, counsel, I want to raise the question what this case is doing here. You're arguing only state law issues. There's no diversity of citizenship. The amount in controversy is likely under 75,000. Why are we here? Now, I anticipate the answer, well, we made 1983 claims in the district court, but the 1983 claims were, as far as I can see, frivolous. You alleged, for example, that malicious prosecution violated your substantive due process rights. That's a theory the Supreme Court rejected in 1994, in Albright against Oliver, and which this court said in 2001 was essentially dead on arrival. And we held in a case that year that there just is no federal 1983 malicious prosecution claim unless state law refuses to entertain malicious prosecution claims, which meant, we said, there was no such federal malicious prosecution claim in Illinois in particular. And then 7 years after we held that there is no such federal claim, here you are pleading such a federal claim as the basis for taking the state claim into federal court. My question is, why shouldn't we order this case dismissed and send you to state court?
What brought us here was not only do we have a substantive due process claim in federal, when we filed in federal court, we also had an equal protection claim. And
it's all the same claim pleaded in different language. And it's, I must say, unless we were just to defy the Supreme Court, we could not find any of this non-frivolous. And you, of course, have pretty much recognized that because you've given up on the federal claim.
Well, we filed in federal court with a substantive due process claim, but also an equal protection claim, alleging a class of one based upon her special, unique treatment in this particular case with these facts and the fact that she was a Hispanic female. After the district court's ruling on the federal and state claims, we felt that our strongest case, remaining cause of action was the common law malicious prosecution claim, and seeking review of especially that portion of the district court's decision is the reason that we are here.
You know, by the way, that the Supreme Court has held that public employees suing their employers don't have any class of one claim, that it's not a viable theory at all.
In this case,
I think that we will ask you and your adversary to file supplemental briefs after argument explaining why there is any federal jurisdiction in this case. And you'll need to deal with Albright and Newsom against McCabe and other similar cases, none of which is discussed in your filings so far.
I will do that, Your Honor. To the merits of the case, simply we allege regarding the core of our case, malicious prosecution, that the conduct at issue was not a violation of the criminal statute that she was charged with violating. She immediately made an unkind, untoward remark, which, as defendants pointed out in their briefs, alarmed some people. The police did an investigation, and they basically concluded that There was no violation here. At best, a misdemeanor or city ordinance violation, not worth prosecuting. At that point, the defendants cooked up a new theory, a fabricated theory, that one of the person mentioned in the phone thread or postal remark was an elected public official.
I've got an independent question about your state law theory. Whether a particular person is a public official, if I understand Illinois law correctly, is the difference between a felony and a misdemeanor. But it seems to me that to have a malicious prosecution claim, you have to show that no reasonable person could have thought that your client committed any crime. The fact that they charged her with the wrong crime when she'd obviously committed a misdemeanor is very hard to see how that's a malicious prosecution claim. Or am I missing some part of Illinois law?
Actually, there was, I believe, a Seventh Circuit decision last December.
Illinois law.
Applying the law of malicious prosecution, and I've cited this case several times in the district court and other cases, holding that a malicious prosecution can apply to a particular charge, otherwise the police are free to tag on additional charges.
Is there some state case supporting the proposition that somebody who should have been charged with a misdemeanor and is in fact charged with a felony can bring a malicious prosecution claim under Illinois law?
The best I can recall is there was only one unpublished district court decision approximately 4 or 5 years ago, and then the Seventh Circuit case.
Have district courts. I'm asking for Illinois decisions.
I know of none, Your Honor.
Right.
And this question of whether Schein was a public official to justify felony prosecution, isn't that a legal question?
Well, I would argue it's a combination of fact and law.
Yeah, the proper facts have to be there to support the legal conclusion that he fits the definition of a public official, and that a witness, whoever it was, Pappas, said he's a public official. That really doesn't suggest that Pappas controlled the prosecutor's decision to charge it as a felony, does it?
Well, what it suggests is that, as the defendants admit, this prosecution was based solely upon representations by Pappas and Schein that he was a public official. And in order to get that
I don't understand that, because the Illinois statute that defines the term public official appears to call for the person either to be an elected official or somebody whose duties are set forth in a statute. And that takes me to Mr. Patel and his supervisor, O'Brien. This isn't something exclusively within the province of the treasurer's office. If there's an Illinois statute, unless there's some set of Illinois statutes that are secret that I don't know about, there should have been a statute. Now, maybe Mr. Patel was careless, you know, I don't know, or inexperienced, but I've had the same issue that Judge Tinder was raising. This looks like a question of law, and they can offer their opinion on it, but there is independent verification.
Well, what happened was the prosecution began as a misdemeanor municipal ordinance violation. It was basically going to die. And then Pappas and Schein came forth, and Pappas was chief legal counsel of the Cook County Treasurer's Office. She, of all people, would know whether Schein's position was prescribed by statute, defined by statute. It wasn't.
What we don't know is whether she was bearing in mind that the particular definition of public official for this set of concerns requires that definition, because, of course, in some colloquial sense, of course Mr. Schein was a public official. He worked for the Cook County Treasurer.
Well, there's lots of statutes which depend upon the status of the so-called victim to define the level of prosecution. For example, disarming a police officer. If you try to disarm a simple security officer, that is not a violation of that statute. If a security officer said, that person disarmed me, charge him. If the prosecutor said, well, you're not a police officer, the person lied and said he was a police officer, that would be malicious prosecution. That's basically what happened here.
Don't you need malice, too?
Well, malice in malicious prosecution is hard to prove directly, because typically the defendant does not admit to having malice or ill will or harm. The fact that we allege that this was a knowing and willing fabrication, that this person was a public official as defined by the statute, in order to charge criminally Maria Avila with a felony prosecution. We know that these defendants had it out for her. She was a target. They wanted her fired.
Now,
there was disciplinary hearings.
Do you think that Pappas was participating in the prosecutorial function? Do you think she was assisting the prosecutors?
She was working with Shine, and she was working directly with the police.
So the police. Because what I'm getting at is, if you had tried to sue Patel, for example, you would have run up against a version of immunity, since under Imbler against Packman, you can't sue the prosecutors for pursuing cases in courts. And if you think Vicki Pappas was really helping the prosecutors, that's a conceivable problem.
I think she was helping. I think she was a quote unquote co-conspirator with the complaining witness, who we allege is liable for malicious prosecution.
Okay.
There's no further questions. We ask that the district court be reversed. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Kochinkowska.
Yes. May it please the court. My name is Pavlina Kochinkowska, and I represent the defendants in this matter. Plaintiff's malicious prosecution claim fails where she admits to making the threats which form the basis of her arrest and the basis for her prosecution.
Now, doesn't your brief overstate this a bit, though? In your brief, you say that she threatened to murder people. You're going to come in with a gun and shoot these various three people, but it seems she just says, I might go postal and you better duck.
There were both versions in the record, Your Honor. The record does support our statement of fact in our brief that she did tell Geneva Fitch that she was going to come in and shoot the three supervisors that she named. It was the plaintiff herself who denied using the word shoot and said that she would, quote, go postal.
So don't we need to take the facts in the light most favorable to the opponent of summary judgment? That's a question of fact.
Yes, Your Honor, but using the term going postal is the equivalent of coming in to shoot. It is an understanding that she was referring to serious workplace violence when she used that term. The plaintiff has failed to make out the elements of a state malicious prosecution claim before the district court, and again fails before this court.
Now, of course, if Judge Easterbrook is right and this case should be dismissed for want of federal jurisdiction, you'll be right back in state court because you won't have a decision on the merits anymore.
Well, Your Honor, the district court did decide to reach the merits in their grant.
It's not up to the district court, though, if there's no federal jurisdiction.
Your Honor, it's our position that where they fail to meet all of the elements of their claim, that it would be properly, hopefully, disposed of here.
I understand that's your position, but I'm saying that as far back as the beginning of time, if there is no federal jurisdiction, meaning at the district court level there is no statute conferring jurisdiction on the district court, then you just have to dismiss because the court has no power to act, and that means anything that's done thereafter is of no effect. So should we find, once you file your supplemental briefs, that there is jurisdiction, then we'll go on to the merits and we'll consider the arguments about this malicious prosecution claim. Should we find that that the district court should have thrown the case out at the threshold, then there's no ruling on the merits, and your opponents would be free to refile in state court subject to statutes of limitations and other requirements in the state courts.
That would be correct, Your Honor. I mean, at this point, we are hoping that this court would reach the merits.
Since you are.
First, the plaintiff has failed to show that the prosecution was based on the action of defendants. Contrary to what counsel just indicated, the defendants do not admit that the prosecution was based solely on the actions of defendants. To the contrary.
He says that's not the test, though. You just said the word solely, and he says as long as the defendants contributed somehow to the prosecution, that's enough.
Well, we don't believe that that's enough. I believe counsel did use the word solely a moment ago. But looking at the cases that they cite to in support of this proposition, we see that they all have something in common. They involve a set of facts where police personnel, detectives, or lab technicians fabricate inculpatory evidence or actively attempt to conceal exculpatory evidence. And that's a far cry from the facts that we have in this case. What we have in this case is a complaining witness, Michael Shine, who decided to take a threat of a shooting in the workplace seriously and report that to police. Now, what happened from there was not his doing. They may have suggested that he was a public official based on their understanding of the statute, but it was the detective who went on and did his own analysis of the statute and determined that he did, in fact, have probable cause to make the arrest. And the felony review assistant state's attorney, who did his own analysis of the statute, did some research into the cases, and even consulted with his supervisor. And they both agreed that that was the appropriate statute. And so under the statute, a public official can be elected to office in accordance with the statute, or, quote, appointed to an office which is established and the qualifications and duties of which are prescribed by statute to discharge a public duty for the state or any of its political subdivisions. We believe that it's easy to see why the defendants could have been confused by that legal definition, where the detective believed that that was the right charge and two assistant state's attorneys believed that that was the appropriate charge. The plaintiff's argument further centers on the contention that Vicki Pappas, quote, actively urged charges in this case. But as the district court pointed out, that would not be supported by the record, where the plaintiff admitted that Vicki Pappas had no input into Assistant State's Attorney Patel's decision to charge the plaintiff and did not tell him or insist that the plaintiff be charged with a particular crime.
Does the record show any conversations between Vicki Pappas and Mr. Patel?
No, it does not. It does not, Your Honor. The cases the plaintiff cites also had statements of fact which show an innocent plaintiff who had no part in the crime that they were charged with and basically involved a false charge against an innocent plaintiff. And again, that's not what we have in this case. What we have in this case is a plaintiff that admits that the threat that she made was, quote, abominable and unjustifiable. And so in the end, what we have is an error as to the appropriate charge to be brought. She was always going to be charged with something. It was a matter of, would it be a misdemeanor, aggravated assault, handgun, protected employee? Would it be a telephone threat, or would it be this felony charge? And there was an error.
The list you've just rattled off, is the public official statute the only felony of
yes.
the possible things you've just talked about?
Well, the aggravated assault, handgun, I believe. I'm not certain, Your Honor. But regardless, it was not the plaintiff's choice as to the charge. And so the error as to the choice in charges did not fall with any of the defendants. It was the prosecutor that made that ultimate decision. The plaintiff also failed to show that there was no probable cause in this case. And the existence of probable cause is a complete defense to any malicious prosecution suit. And there was ample probable cause in this case. What we had here was a plaintiff who told a coworker, because she was facing a disciplinary hearing where she thought she might very likely lose her job, that she was going to come in with a gun and shoot three of her supervisors, including Michael Shine, that she would go postal on them. Her coworker, Geneva Fitch, told her not to talk like that. And the plaintiff responded by saying that she was serious and that Geneva Fitch should duck when she came into work. Now, Geneva Fitch became even more concerned because the plaintiff and Ms. Fitch had plans to have breakfast before work the next day, and the plaintiff did not come to breakfast and did not come to work. Her disciplinary hearing was originally scheduled for that following Wednesday after a holiday weekend. And so she became worried because she did not say that she was blowing off steam or that she was just joking. To the contrary, she said that she was serious and that she should duck when she comes in. The plaintiff also had a prior disciplinary history, had demonstrated anger towards her bosses, and the employees in the treasurer's office on that Tuesday, which was the next business day, were understandably afraid. People were crying in the office. They were afraid to be near Michael Shine or any of the supervisors who had been threatened. And so at that point, first thing in the morning at about 9 a.m., that's when defendant Michael Shine decided to call the police and notify them. Detective Schlater was told that Michael Shine was an appointed official because he was, in fact, appointed by the treasurer herself on December 1st of 1998. And there's nothing in the record to show that he did not believe that he was a public official under the statute at the time that he made those statements. The plaintiff has also failed to show that any defendant acted with malice. This is especially in light of the fact that they admit that Vicki Pappas did not have any input into the state's attorney's decision to charge the plaintiff and did not insist that she be charged with any particular crime. Where the plaintiff has failed to establish that the prosecution was based on the action of defendants, failed to show that there was no probable cause, and failed to show that any defendant proceeded maliciously, we believe that summary judgment was properly granted, and we ask that the judgment be affirmed. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to remind counsel for both sides that the court invites the filing of supplemental memoranda addressing whether the district court possessed subject matter jurisdiction in this case. Memoranda should be filed within 14 days, and they should discuss at least the Supreme Court's decision in Albright against Oliver and its decision in Enquist against Oregon Department of Agriculture and this court's decision in Newsom against McCabe and any other matters counsel deem pertinent to subject matter jurisdiction. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow.